kind of as good as the show itself. And if you stay on for that, you get to find out a little bit more about Paul Robeson himself and when he came to go to the museum with your local thirst for knowledge will be wet. What's the other thing I wanted to tell you? Tayo loves it if people applaud after songs, so don't be shy. So we're going to open the doors just shortly, and meanwhile Maria's going to take your tickets, just check your tickets, and then I'll let you know when we're ready for you.
This is from an article on the Maritime Union's website at the moment. Maritime Union supports UK award-winning play about Paul Robeson at Fringe New Zealand. Paul Robeson is a name that would be known to most trade unionists of the older generation and to many younger ones well-versed in labour and trade union history. One of the most famous artists and activists of the 20th century, the African American was an international superstar whose name has sadly been all but buried from history because of the threat he posed through his words and music to political and commercial elites worldwide. Paul Robeson had a special connection with Wellington Waterside Workers and was awarded life membership of the Waterside Workers Union, now the Maritime Union of New Zealand, during his visit in 1960. His life is to be portrayed on stage as one of the highlights of Fringe New Zealand in an award-winning play to be seen in the Thorndon suburb of Wellington from February 20 to March 1st. Robeson travelled to New Zealand in 1960 and stayed here for 2 weeks and 4 days. During this time, he visited dockside workers in Wellington and spoke out bravely in defence of Māori and working people. Robeson's visit to Wellington, the fiery speeches and the uplifting songs that were exchanged between the great man and the striking dockside workers are still remembered vividly by former dockside workers in Wellington. He addressed the Waterside Special Stockwork Meeting and accepted lifelong membership of the Maritime Union. This was to be his last ever concert tour.
Nobody knows the trouble I see.
Paul Robeson, I said. Paul Robeson. No. R-O-B-E-S-O-N.
They said that I had been struggling for the independence of the colonial peoples of Africa and that is meddling in the foreign affairs of the United States government. Now that's too bad, because I'm going to have to continue to meddle. Because my father was a slave, and my people died to build this country, and I'm gonna stay here and have a part of it just like you, and no fascist-minded people will drive me from it. Is that clear?
All men river, and all men river, he must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along.
She's seen all there is to see from the dawn of time. It's Mother Africa. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, but I... Can I have the house lights on, please? We have white people down here and Negro people up there. For this reason, I'm afraid I have to say that this concert is now over.
The play is called Mr. Robeson, and it's been devised and is performed by Teo Aluko. It is an impressive piece of theatre. I really enjoyed it. It is taking place as part of the New Zealand Fringe Festival, and it's performed in the Moorings, which is I think a perfect setting for it. It's a residential property where a lot of people live communally, which also happens to have a ballroom in it, this kind of tumbly down ballroom, which is just, it's just perfect. It's a perfect setting. You sort of walk through the rather elite suburb of Thorndon, and then just you're encased in this beautiful building and by this beautiful performance. The performance has a lot to say about the politics of the past, but I also think it speaks a lot to the politics of today. Yeah, it's a beautiful piece of theatre. Teo has taken this play all around the world, which is kind of interesting as well, as a portable piece of theatre. And he's been very busy since he got here, but he took time out to have a chat with me, which I'm very grateful for. We sat in a very nice pub in Thorndon and had a chat. And I hope you find it an interesting interview. I think it gives a really good insight into how a piece is sort of devised. And yeah, and it has something to say about politics and art. Oh, my two favourite things. Anyway, thank you very much. One of the things that I really enjoyed about the show last night is that at the end of it there was a Q&A, and someone asked about how you came to the story and how you decided to devise the piece that you have. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, certainly. I live in Liverpool in England, and I had been there for 12 years or so, and had become known in a small way as a singer,
mm-hmm.
As an amateur, because it was a hobby. But I had been invited one particular day to take part in an event on the summer solstice, June 23rd, 1995. And as a fundraiser for Sefton Park Palm House, the refurbishment of the Palm House, they had something they called the Dawn Chorus. So people gathered for tea and so on, and one of the elements was music, and I had been asked to sing. And I chose what I thought was a very appropriate song, a spiritual called My Lord, What a Morning.
Oh, beautiful.
And after I had sung that, I sang a few other things, I know that, but and then somebody came up to me afterwards, a lady came up to me afterwards and said, you remind me of Paul Robeson.
Oh my goodness.
Do you sing many of his songs? At that time, I was 33 years old. I had been working for myself as an architect for a while. I had 3 architectural degrees, so well-educated man. But I hadn't heard of Paul Robeson. And so what I said to her was, I think I know the name, but I'm not sure what his music is. And pure chance and good fortune, 2 months after that, I happened to be in the library in Liverpool looking for something on civil rights history or something or the other, or biography, and then this book was there on the shelf with Paul Robeson. I remembered the name, borrowed it, and it literally changed my life, because I discovered this amazing story, which I decided there and then, as soon as I finished it, that I had to share this story somehow. The story has to be told, and I can see it as a play. So I went off looking for playwrights to suggest that they write the play. But I found difficulty finding playwrights. I found some, they didn't quite work out very well, even though there were some of them, you know, were good writers. But it just didn't feel, what they did didn't quite feel right. And so 10 years after I'd read the biography, I decided to have a go at writing myself. And my first effort was, looking back at it now, you know, was not great, but it was a start. And I shared it with somebody who I had met by pure chance, and she, over the next few years, guided me into what it is today.
Mm. It's really, it always interests me how people come to writing.
Mm.
And I mean, it's an impossible thing to answer this question. It's a silly question in a lot of ways, but did you see the play and then transcribe what you saw, or can you remember that process at all? Did you speak it out and then write, or how can you remember that process at all?
I think I can. I think I remember that I imagined a number of characters in
mm-hmm.
this play
mm.
with Paul Robeson.
Yeah.
So it in fact started off as a 6-character play.
Wow.
And I wanted there were two definite characters that I remember best, who don't exist anymore because it is now a one-man
mm,
play.
Mm, mm.
But the first character I had in mind was somebody I called Jessica Hopwood,
mm-hmm.
a made-up name. And it was she was an American woman, I think, a white American woman, who for me was an amalgamation of a number of white women with whom Paul Robeson had extramarital
mm-hmm.
affairs.
Mm.
The other character that I had was the spirit of an African woman.
Mm-hmm.
Who would appear to Paul Robeson, and he would be the only person to be able to see this woman, and she was like a storyteller from the past.
Mm-hmm.
And she, in fact, as I speak now, I think I'm remembering that her spirit, she was the ghost, if you like, of a woman who had existed, who had been an ancestor, even though she is African, she
mm-hmm.
was an ancestor of this white woman.
Mm, mm.
And the story that I was trying to tell then, which is a very fascinating story, is the fact that the transatlantic slave trade took part with the involvement both of African chiefs and traders
mm.
and white traders.
Mm.
And I had discovered while I was in Liverpool that this fact that, you know, Africans had been very active in trading
mm,
mm. And that there is a school in Liverpool which exists to this day called the Blue Coat School. And I had heard that as far back as the 17th century, African chiefs had sent their sons to this school to be educated so that they could be in a good position to trade with the white
mm,
man.
Mm.
And that I found incredibly fascinating.
That, yeah.
that, you know, that Liverpool had this history. And I wanted to bring that history into this play about Paul Robeson.
Mm.
So, you know, the family of the slave, black slave trading family from a fictional African country had sent their son, left the daughter behind who had been abused by a white slave trader or something or the other. And so this woman would appear to Paul Robeson and he would look mad, but she would tell him stories and so on. So that was, and then after a while it grew from a six character play, it actually grew to 14 characters. And then because I went to a conference in the United States on songs by African American composers, I'd been invited to that, and I thought that would be a good place to present my work in progress.
Yeah, yeah.
So I actually read at the end of the conference, I read the draft that I had with me for the 14 character thing. I read it to whoever wanted to stay and listen to that. And as I was reading that, it occurred to me, actually, this could work as a one-man play. And that's how, again, with the guidance of my director, Olushola Oyeleye, I sort of transformed it into a monodrama.
I was talking to someone about it today, and I think that I won't put it right because I don't come from theatre people, but I feel like it works so well, that mix of telling a life, like a person telling their life, but the way that it often slips into acting that life, do you know what I mean? Like the way, you know, the very powerfulness of how you're sort of brought into the story by someone telling their story, but then all of a sudden you're right there experiencing it. And I think it's so well devised. Like, I just think that it is so well devised and just so well written. I think that the pacing of it, and I teach people how to write nonfiction work.
Okay.
And I always am interested by that, the way that when you're writing a true life story, you are dragged. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like that stuff keeps you sort of honest or something. And, and the challenge of it often makes the work even better.
That's right. I mean, being presented with a life story of like Paul Robeson's, I mean, that is such a gift, because I guess anybody's life is interesting, but his life, I mean, there are very few people that I can think of whose life actually represents world history. World history from his being, his having been the son of African, captured Africans, you know, and slaves in the United States. So he had that history, but then the slavery in the United States, their fight for emancipation, and then the ongoing fight for civil rights. So that's interesting enough in itself. But then for Paul Robeson to then find himself introduced to the socialism. And that introduction took place in the in England, having met Welsh miners. He then found himself going to the Soviet Union, finding and then being interested and enamored by socialism and communism, and then finding him and then deciding or understanding that human rights struggles around the world are, you know, it's one big struggle regardless of race. So one very interesting story, and in the play I actually reenact a speech that he made in 1937 at the Royal Albert Hall in London, where he's at a fundraiser for refugees from the Spanish Civil War on the side of the Spanish Republicans, fighting for the Spanish Republic, and against the fascist regime of General Franco. And he says that the artist must take sides. He must elect to fight for slavery or freedom. And I have made my choice. I had no alternative. And it's absolutely remarkable that an African-American was speaking on a stage in London in defense of Spanish people fighting fascism. And that, as far back as 1937, is a wonderful demonstration of how internationalist Paul Robeson was at a very, very early stage in recent world history. And is a demonstration of why he was always seen as particularly dangerous.
This is the thing that really struck me. You know, like I was moved to tears quite often through the work, but this idea, it was interesting because my husband and I, who saw it with me, he sort of said to me, it's strange that there hasn't been a film about this man's life. And I said, yes, but the cause is still dangerous, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Like, what he stood for
exactly
is still quite a...
Exactly.
You know, and I was just thinking, the thing that really struck me, as well as just this magnificent life he had, and also the strength and bravery and courage to keep going, like,
yeah,
through that hideousness. And what I think is great about your presentation is that, the way that the piece is devised, is that for every one Paul Robeson, you realise that there's probably a dock worker, and there's probably
yeah,
a, you know, a coal miner, and there's probably
mm-hmm,
a farmer, and there's probably a secretary, and you just realise the horror of that.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it also seems ever present now.
Yeah, boy, yes.
Which I think, as well as being important to memorialise and to, you know, like, talk about this man's amazing life, I think that it does push a lot of buttons about what's going on at the moment.
Very much so. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about telling the story, and why I try every time I perform the play to write something for the particular audience that's seeing the play about why Paul Robeson remains relevant to this very day.
Mm.
And so coming to New Zealand, for instance, for my first time ever, as I said in the program notes, one of the things that I learned was that the New Zealand government is planning to send troops back to Iraq.
Mm, yeah.
And, right, I don't know much about New Zealand history. I don't know much about what's going on in New Zealand today. But I do know that Paul Robeson said in his time, and there are people here in New Zealand, I'm pretty sure, I don't know who they are, but there are people all over the world, and there will be those here in New Zealand saying that we should not be spending money and spending young people's lives on warmongering
mm,
when there are very much more important creative things to be doing at home.
Mm. Yeah.
And so Paul Robeson, throughout his life, spoke passionately about peace and brotherhood of between nations. And that, unfortunately, because of the vested interests everywhere, was one of the reasons why he always got himself, he was always in trouble with the authorities, because peace apparently doesn't make money the way that war does. And warmongering does. So, his story is definitely relevant. And, I find this whenever I go to political rallies or whatever, or just to hear somebody speak from, you know, for instance, I was at the Women's Centre in London, and they had brought over an activist, a woman from Haiti,
mm-hmm,
who's fighting for Haitian women's rights. And just listening to that person was incredibly inspiring. And I know that, you know, just telling Paul Robeson's story is inspiring to people who hear it, and therefore just encourages people to fight for whatever rights that they are, you know, gives them encouragement in whatever struggles they're fighting against, mm-hmm, wherever they are.
And I think, I mean, that idea of an artist has to take sides.
Yes.
Like, I think that that's not often a popular, you know, there seems, I don't know, God, I could talk all night. But, you know, like, there does seem to be a sort of opiate of celebrity and,
yes,
you know, and there aren't a lot of people taking sides in a lot,
yes,
of very dangerous ways. And
that's right.
When you look at Robeson's life, when you look at Paul Robeson's life, it really was,
yeah,
it was disregard, like, because I think he was fully aware of the consequences of his actions,
oh boy,
wasn't he?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. It's as though he, you know, people, it's as though he felt that he had a calling.
Mm.
From a young age, he knew he had this gift as a singer. He had this remarkable, deep voice.
Mm.
And he embarked on a professional career as a singer and actor, because actually he'd been denied opportunities as a lawyer, which is what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
But then this career opened up to him. very rapidly he became very famous and started to become very rich. But at the same time, he was developing this political consciousness.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know, I can't say exactly where he said this, but it must have been the fact that he decided that his life and his gifts and his talents were preparing him to give service to people by using this voice to help them in their struggles. And he said in a radio interview and many times that he sees his art, he saw his art, his singing, as a weapon in defense of his people and all oppressed people of the world. There are not many people that we can think of today who do exactly that. There are many. There are some. I mean, the one that comes most immediately to mind is a very relatively unknown American guy whose name will come to me in a second. But he goes around folk clubs in Europe. He's been to New Zealand and Australia, actually. What's his name? David Rovick.
Oh, yeah.
David Rovick, yeah. Yes. I've met him. So you meet people like that, you're inspired by the way they just dedicate their life and their art to bettering the human condition. And, you just feel humbled by the life that somebody like Robeson lived and people like, and you just think, I've been given a gift and it's not mine to use just to make money. It's something that can share, can serve humanity.
Because there's something that again really hit me last night. There was some footage that I found of him singing with the people that were building the Sydney Opera House.
That's right.
And I was saying to a friend the other day, a lot of the songs, how can I put this? I feel like I've been kind of disconnected from their root or their intent, if you know what I mean. Like, the songs become commercialized and people own them, and it becomes sort of a bit of a parody. But I think what is amazing is that from the performance last night, I really started to, like a song like Old Man River.
Yes.
You know, like, I have heard that song since I was a child, and I have a certain idea about what that song is, and da da da. But there's something about the show and the way that the songs are intersected in the life that renews the sort of heart and emotion of those songs.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite remarkable. And especially, is it Joe Hill?
Yes.
Yeah. Even saying the name, I'm off again. But there's something about those songs, and you talk a little bit about in the play, you as Paul Robeson, talk a little bit about that theory of the black keys,
the pentatonic scale.
Yeah, and I don't even know. This isn't really a question, really. It's just I'm enamored. But those songs, there is something about those songs that I sort of have an idea of them, and you've managed to shift that idea.
That's
and
right.
I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that sort of. Those songs. That
A good example in the play is the scene in Kansas City, the Kansas City the municipal auditorium in Kansas City, where I tell the story of Paul Robeson in a concert, and he starts the concert and he's singing a song. The Old Folks at Home, which is an old-fashioned, I don't know whether they call them sepia songs, but it's and written by a white man called John Foster. And it's song about an old black family, old black slavery times, and this person is talking about you know, the people who have gone, who have died, and he's waiting to die and meet them. But then halfway through the song, he realizes that he's singing in a segregated audience. The black people are upstairs in the balcony. He stops the song, walks off stage, decide, you know, is persuaded to come back, and then he sings a spiritual.
Mm.
Now, he doesn't just sing any spiritual, like Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen. He sings a spiritual, Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho,
yes.
Which for me is one of the most powerful, that is one of the most powerful songs ever. And the history of that, you know, that's a spiritual which is inspired by a story of Jewish people in slavery in Egypt. Joshua is a leader who, you know, the line in the play says, Joshua commanded the children to shout and the wall come tumbling down, you know?
Wow.
So that spiritual, for me, is one that typifies African people's struggle, determination to survive, but the need to win your own emancipation by fighting whatever means necessary. And in fact, my Paul Robeson, coming into contact with Paul Robeson has inspired another piece of writing stroke singing, which I call From Black Africa to the White House.
Awesome.
And it's subtitled A Journey in Resistance, Triumph, and Spirituals, in which I talk about African history from way before the transatlantic slave trade, you know, in most parts a history of great achievement to the slave trade, and then civil rights struggles in the United States, in Africa, you know, anti-colonial struggles, and Caribbean and elsewhere. And I sing spirituals all the way through that. And I sing that kind of spiritual to show that spirituals themselves are not just songs about African Americans waiting for Jesus to come and save them.
Yeah.
A lot of the time they are coded messages, like Steal Away, for instance, is one song which, and I didn't know this, and I had sung this song, that when on a plantation people are singing Steal Away, they're actually saying to everybody else that there is one person who's going to try and escape tonight, prepare the way for him or her. And of course the white masters wouldn't know that. And that was so it's, you know, as you say, these songs you lose the meaning of them if you're not aware of the real history of them. Joe Hill is another good another good one, which is not many people outside the labor movement know it, but it's a story of a trade unionist who went to the United States from somewhere in Scandinavia in the 19th century, was killed by the trade the bosses of the copper mines because he led a very successful strike. And a song was written about him, and it's a trade union rallying song because he said, as he was being, as he was waiting to be shot by the firing squad, because he was framed for a murder he didn't commit. And he said to the assembled miners, don't mourn for me, organize. And this is 18th century. And that, in fact, was Paul Robeson's favorite song. And it is such a gift that from a story that far back, I am able to actually share that song with people in Wellington and around the world today, to remind people that, you know, the rights that workers enjoy today or have enjoyed historically, which which are constantly under threat, have been won by people literally dying, you know, to achieve those rights and freedoms. So it's necessary to keep reminding people of the struggle that other people have waged on our behalf, and it is incumbent on us to continue that struggle.
Because that's what I found as well as you know, sort of challenging, you know, confronting those things in myself, you know, sort of thinking, oh my God, you know, like these are hard won rights.
Yes.
They also, the songs also were extremely, I don't know what the word is, like motivating, and was one song that you sang, and I was just thinking about how the spiritual and the idea of equality and socialism work so well. The one, I can't even, I think the chorus sort of goes, dang yeah, and
Daniel.
Yeah, and it talks about how Jesus,
my Lord, deliver Daniel. Yes.
And I just thought it's so wonderful because what it's saying is, you know, like, there's equality of love, you know, sort of from this heavenly being.
That's
and there's this idea that, you know, that equality kind of balances to the... Because that was an amazing part of the story for me, is the equality that Robeson found in the Soviet Union.
Yes.
And in England that he didn't find in America.
Yes.
Yeah. And that is a political that's a politically motivated equality and non-equality, do you think? Or... like, why was Russia so progressive? You know, like, what's the magic?
Yes. Oh, I don't. That's a big question.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Russia was my knowledge of communism and socialism is not as deep as one might expect. But my basic understanding is that the socialist system exists to provide equal opportunities to everybody. Communism, it becomes communism when the state dictates that's what everybody has to do. And if it doesn't happen naturally, everybody will be forced to do it, and, you know, you'll be forced into collective farming, and if you don't, you know, and basically you can die doing so, you know. But so when Paul Robeson went to the Soviet Union in 1934, he saw socialism at work. And the other thing that he saw was that he was seen as a man, unlike what he was seen in the United States as a Negro, you know, a second-class citizen. And anybody that goes to a place like that, from a place like the United States in the 1920s and 30s, is bound to be impressed by the system that produces that kind of treatment of him. So, that's why he believed in socialism. He then came to realize several, you know, decade and a half later, that actually the communist leadership is very corrupt. But he retained his faith in socialism, understood that, like any organization, be it the church or politics or whatever, church, religious organization, systems, that the people at the top can often corrupt the intention of what was created. And I think he just saw that that's what happened with the Soviet Union, but he decided not to speak about it publicly. Because there was a bad enough press already.
That story was being told.
Exactly.
So
he just wanted to carry on telling the story of the benefits and the potential of true democratic socialism.
It was really powerful for me. It was really powerful. So, where do you go from here? Like, the show's been performed in a lot of places, which is really exciting for me. And so you guys, the play begins again in Wellington on the 26th I think.
I'll
make sure everyone knows. But so after New Zealand, where do you go from?
After New Zealand, I go to Adelaide.
Oh, great.
Yes.
Oh, great.
There's the Fringe Festival there. So for a few days in March, and then I go back to the UK.
Yeah.
I'm touring around England and Wales.
Right.
And planning my autumn season as well, and
great.
For 2016. And I'm also working on a new play.
Great.
Which will also be a one-man play with songs.
Mm.
So it'll be for me and a pianist. And it's similar themes. This is a man, actually another man who existed, but his story is nothing like as interesting as Paul Robeson's. But it's a man who was a Nigerian who ended up in London working as a lawyer. But looking back at, just looking at the African condition, liberation struggles in Africa in particular, touching on African-American, you know, African history, but then singing songs ranging from a song that he learned as a teenager in Nigeria, because I actually learned this song and sang it as a solo in a Victorian ballad.
Oh, wow.
So that's the first song he sings, but then basically to talk about how the history of colonization in Nigeria sort of presents Nigeria, colonial subjects with a particular British culture. But then through song, like spirituals and liberation songs, you can use art as a tool to liberate yourself physically and mentally and emotionally. But and this guy was particularly interested in sport. So he talks about political sporting stories, for instance, boycotting South Africa internationally in cricket and other games. And 1968 Olympics, where there was a great symbolic action by African Americans. So he's an observer of all these world events.
Fantastic.
Without really contributing himself, but he's in this setting telling these stories, and it's something I'm working on that I'm quite excited by.
It sounds fantastic. And there's another New Zealand link, of course, because we also had quite a lot of action against apartheid here.
Exactly.
And, you know, I mean, sorry to just put in another plug for New Zealand politics, but, you know, Paul Robeson came here and,
yes.
you know, like, yeah, it's fantastic. It sounds great. Can I just ask you one more question?
Yes.
Thank you. You've been so generous with your time. I was interested, what's it like working with a different piano player? Like, it was so good having the piano there. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just think it would be a different show if there was pre-recorded music. And
oh boy, yes.
I guess what I'm also getting at is the whole portability of the show. Like,
mm-hmm.
the set is just beautiful and just seemed to look so good in the moorings. And, and then I looked at a couple of other photos of it being done in other places, and the set, I love the way the set kind of morphs to fit the stage and you know,
exactly,
and a different, what's it like moving a show around like that? Exhausting. No,
it is exhausting. I mean, interestingly, the set that you see there today, you saw yesterday, was half of the set that I showed up at the airport with.
Oh.
I got to the airport, not having traveled with Etihad before, to realize that I knew it was heavier than, but I didn't realize how much they were going to charge me for.
Oh no!
For the excess luggage, so I left half of it in England.
Wow! Well, the set's beautiful.
But it
was good.
It was just as well, and I made it work here. So, yeah, you sort of get to a space and you adapt to the conditions that you find. For instance, you saw the show with no lighting changes.
Yeah.
There are something like 40 lighting cues in the play. But the story is the main thing. But most important is the music.
Yeah.
Which was what Paul Robeson was. And it's, you know, so I do meet a different pianist everywhere I go. I send the music ahead of time, maybe 2 weeks ahead, with instructions. I send the script as well. And then we meet a few days beforehand and rehearse. And one of the most important things actually is finding and choosing the right type of person in the first place.
Right.
Certainly I was very lucky to know somebody, Jan Hind, who knew the right kind of person. And Julian Raphael turned out to be perfect. And today was the third performance, and we are gelling more and more with each performance, and different things come out every time. So not only is every setting different, every performance is different.
Yeah.
And that's part of the thing that keeps it fresh and interesting for me.
Because that's what I found so great. It's sort of, as the performance went on, Julian almost became Larry, if you know what I mean. You know, like, it was like, oh, Larry. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, yeah, they've been working together for years. And, you know, it was really astounding. And as far as those lighting changes go, your performance is just so fucking amazing that, you know, I saw the lighting changes in my head. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was just a shift in your face. And it was just fantastic. Like, I just can't believe how much I enjoyed it. Thank you so much. But, yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate
Great
you taking
pleasure.
The time. And all the best for the rest of the run
thank
in
you.
Adelaide, and it'll be wonderful.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Thank you.